There's a nonprofit group in Anchorage called the Alaska Business Development Center, and they participate in a program sponsored by the IRS to send tax preparers to rural Alaskan villages to provide tax assistance for indigenous Alaskans who would not otherwise have resources.
And how big of a program is this, do you know?
Last year, everyone put together, prepared about 10,000 tax returns for rural Alaskans. Wow. Our team this year did 400. Mm-hmm. There were, I think, 80 teams that went out this year to places all throughout Alaska.
So how big of an issue is this for these rural villages?
So the reason, part of the funding comes from the villages itself. The villages are usually part of Native corporations. So mm-hmm. a lot of the indigenous Alaskans are tribal members within these broader corporations. And because most of them end up getting tax refunds, there's a lot of interest in getting tax preparers out. It turns out that it's better for these people to file taxes than it would be otherwise. A lot of their incomes are so low that they end up getting money back because their withholdings often are not done properly, which is one of the things we try to instruct them on. But so the funding for the program comes from three places. One is the IRS sponsors tax preparation for low-income taxpayers, and most of these villagers qualify. Second, the group, the nonprofit in Anchorage, gets funding. And then third, the village, the tribal councils themselves underwrite part of it. And it's a really big logistical undertaking to get people up to Alaska from the lower 48, and then to coordinate the travel to get them out to the rural villages. Getting to Anchorage isn't so hard. You fly, Alaskan Air to get there. But getting out to these rural villages on, four-seater planes, it's expensive. Mm. It's also time-consuming. So the logistical work is pretty onerous that the nonprofit undertakes.
Wow. So how did you first get involved in it?
So last year I was on sabbatical in Anchorage doing a judicial clerkship for the Alaska Supreme Court. And one of my colleagues had participated in the program when he was in law school at NYU. And so he went around the courthouse asking people to volunteer, trying to sell us on the fact that by participating in the program, we would be able to go to Alaskan villages that we would otherwise never see in our lives. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them in some of the most remote places you can imagine. The trade-off is the training is actually kind of extensive. It's about 40 hours of training. You have to get certified by the IRS. But to be able to go to some of these villages and to get the expenses paid to go there, that's the upshot.
So was that your first experience then with this guy who did it, your kind of colleague, I guess, at the Supreme Court? Mm-hmm.
So last year was my first year. I went through the training, and then the trip I did last year was out to the Aleutian Islands off of Southwest Alaska. That was a really neat experience because of all of the fishing that goes on out there. So the tax preparations mostly involved commercial fishermen and people working at a cannery on an island of 600 people. This year, I took four accounting students, and we went. So this is the first year of the partnership between Western Michigan and the nonprofit in Anchorage. So after coming back from my year in Alaska, I wanted to formalize the arrangement and enter into a long-term partnership with the group so that I could take students up every year. And this year, we had two teams, and we were assigned to villages in Western Alaska near Bethel that were also predominantly fishing villages.
So what does it look like in these villages when it comes to being able to get your taxes done? Did these villages have anyone doing their taxes before you guys came through there, or what was it look like?
So surprisingly, a large number of the villagers use TurboTax. We think that before we go out there, we think that, these are isolated and off the grid. Most of the villagers don't have running water, it's true, but a lot of them have internet. Through, of course, satellite, right? Mm-hmm. So Dish Network is very popular in these rural villages. And the first house I went into up there, they're sitting there watching, an NBA game. So it's interesting. You don't want to go there with these preconceptions, but of course you have them. And then, you're disabused of them quickly when you see internet. You see everybody on Facebook, everybody on Gmail and Skype. And those things are actually really important to the villagers because the other village might only be 5 miles away where their family or cousins could live, but there's no cars. Everything's off the road system. The way of getting around during the winter is snowmobile. During the summer, it's boat. So, you know, a lot of these technologies play an important role in them staying in touch with each other.
Can you give me a sense for what these villages actually look like in terms of, I guess on the inside, they've got internet and TV and stuff, but on an, as someone just walking through one of these villages, what's it like?
So there's not many buildings. Building is very expensive. The building materials come in by barge during the summers, obviously, when the water isn't frozen. But it's a lot of clapboard buildings. Almost all of the houses have a very high number of people living in them. So a standard configuration would be there would be some sort of, you know, shared living space, kitchen, dining room, and then two or three bedrooms in the back. Each bedroom have, you know, four people living in it, often family members, often four generations. You often have grandparents, great-grandparents, grandparents, parents, kids, all living because there's nowhere else to go. And the building is very expensive, but that's just the culture. They stay with their families, and I think it also helps consolidate on expenses.
So the first year that you got there, let's start with, I guess, your first experience doing this. What was it like for you? Can you just kind of walk me through? I don't know how long you spent there, but just your time there.
So last year was very different from this year. Last year, the village off the Aleutian Islands was called King Cove, and it was about 600 people on an island. But the industry in the village was a cannery, and it had barracks for the cannery workers to live in. And most of the cannery workers were actually from the Philippines. So the village of 600, half of whom were foreign, and then some of them were native, and some were Caucasian. So that was a very that was certainly one kind of experience. This year, though, the villages off of Bethel were 99% native. So it was a very different demographic, just looking at the people and the experiences and the culture.
Now, with these experiences, I know in an area like Bethel, it's very like bilingual. They have a lot of native tongues as well as English. When it comes to that, how do you actually communicate and work with these people to get their taxes done?
Right. So the villages that we were in are bilingual. The traditional language they speak is called Yupik, but they also speak English. And it may not be that surprising, but the village elders communicate primarily in Yupik, and the kids communicate primarily in English. And we're talking to one of our hosts up there, and she was saying that she really worries about the disappearance of their language. And she has a rule that when kids come to her house, they have to speak in Yupik, which for them is becoming increasingly difficult, whereas the elders speak it quite easily. Some of the villagers also lament the way that cable TV costs them their language, because now they watch the same shows that we do, and it breaks down their exposure to their traditional languages. But there's among the villagers, I think there's a very high premium placed on their culture and the history, and it's something they're deeply passionate about. I mean, they could move and go somewhere else if they wanted to, but these are their communities that they're from, and I think it's very important to a lot of them that they stay there. And a lot of young people stay there too. I was surprised. I thought there'd be a lot of immigration of the young villagers out, say, to Anchorage or Fairbanks. And it was interesting seeing how many people in their 20s were raising their families up there. And a lot of them had gone to Anchorage or Fairbanks for work or for a couple of years, but, you know, a lot of them went back. That's what they're used to, and it's what they like.
Mm-hmm. What did you see as far as culture there? You mentioned it's something that they're trying to hold on to, but were you welcomed into that culture?
It was amazing. As soon as we arrived in the first village, it was the same night of a feast they have feast to commemorate the 40th day of after someone dies. And so we drop our stuff off, and we're all staying in effectively there's like an office building that handles the tribal affairs. So we're sleeping on cots in effectively a workroom. But we show up and we go off to this feast, and this was a village of about 300 people, and probably 150 were in this building, in this house, having, you know, traditional food and with, you know, pictures of the deceased up. And so that first night we got to eat walrus, we got to eat some kind of bird, we got to eat caribou, and the delicacy up there is called salmonberry ice cream, which is salmon berries are a local berry harvested and then blended with Crisco and powdered fish, and sugar, and they make an ice cream out of it. And the students that I was with, I think actually liked it. I did not like it at all. But it was just, it was interesting to show up, you know, drop our stuff off and go to a 40-day death feast and eat walrus. I mean, it was just, it was just surreal. So that's an so I think their food is the other thing that's so interesting. I mean, a lot of these villagers don't have any income. They tell us during the tax training, you know, don't go up there and be judgmental about how does someone live, you know, for a year off a very little salary. But one way that they do it is through subsistence hunting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are stores there where a quart of orange juice could be $15. It's the delivery. There's hardly any produce to be had anywhere. It would be very expensive. But, you know, we're up there and people come back and they just hunted a moose. And a moose weighs, you know, over 1,000 pounds. And that provides, and it's winter, so you can just leave it outside and it freezes. So, you know, the moose provides subsistence for them sustenance for them for the, you know, for a long time. Or during the summer, they do their fishing. And then there's dried fish hanging throughout the village. So, so it really is interesting, sort of just something as fundamental as what do they eat? Or the walrus that we had. We had whale at the second village. And whales are obviously very, very big. So if they're lucky enough to catch a whale, that provides a ton of food, not just for the hunters, but for the village for a long time. They have a very communal philosophy where it's not just the person who gets the whale that gets it, but, you know, the rest of the village gets to share as well.
Now, when it comes to actually filling out the taxes of these people, do you have to fill out like income as far as this quantity of moose I hunted? Is that something you have to fill out, or how does that come into it?
Moose is not taxable. Okay. you actually don't. The biggest. So, I mean, there are some stores up there, or people work for the tribal association. So you have W-2 forms just like you would have down here. Most of it's part-time work. You have teachers in the schools. So some of the tax stuff looks the same there as it would anywhere else. I think the biggest difference is that Alaska has something called the Permanent Fund Dividend, where every Alaskan resident every year gets about $2,000. It's based on an endowment from the oil and the interest that is born from that endowment. Also, there's tax relief for children. So there's the earned income credit and the child tax credit. So it's not exaggerating to say that most of the income for most of these families is unearned income, in the sense that it comes from either the state of Alaska through the PFD or through having kids. And there are a lot of kids. I mean, a lot of families we would routinely see families with 6-8 kids. Maybe it's because it's dark and cold up there, but you know, I think the children are looked at as a source of revenue, you know, having two kids myself, you know, the expenses outweigh the revenue. But that's a big source of the income that you see. And it is interesting, and it's different.
And is it kids that people say when they get this money, and whether it's through the earned income tax credit, through their taxes, or through the permanent dividend fund?
Permanent fund dividend.
Right. PFD. Permanent fund dividend. Is that money what they actually will then use to get the expenses for their children, as far as when it comes to getting them clothing and things like that?
That's right. But again, their expenses are heavily offset by their lifestyles. So they go hunting for the food. So food expenses are low. Mm-hmm. You see a lot of the clothing they make themselves. So the expenses there are low. The housing costs are low because it could be, you know, 8 or 12 people living in one house together. Mm-hmm. The heating expenses are obviously high, and, you know, if there were building, that would be expensive. A lot don't have health care, and the only reason we know that is because of Obamacare. That's now a taxable question that we need to know. And even if they did have health care, there's no treatment facilities. They'd have to fly, I guess in this case, fly back to Bethel, which would be like a 30-minute flight on a small plane, but it's a $300 round-trip flight. So I think the villagers certainly don't have the access to healthcare that we do in any meaningful way.
I'm curious, when it came to training you for this, did you have any accounting experience before this?
Nope.
I'm assuming no. When it came to training you, was it completely I have to assume it was completely unlike any kind of normal tax training because of the kind of people who you're giving tax training to, or who you're doing their taxes for. Is it normal tax training, or do you have to learn different things of how to do the taxes for these people?
So the tax training through the IRS is the same training for everybody in the country. I mean, entering a W-2 is the same, whether it's, you know, Michigan or Alaska. The only substantive difference comes because so many of the villagers are commercial fishermen. So a lot of them live in rural Alaska on rivers, and so they sell their fish. And there's a lot of supplementary training based on what it takes to fill out a Schedule C for fishing income. Or the 1099 MISC forms that they get for their fishing revenues. So so there is some specialized training. I would say the majority of the training is not specialized in any way, but there's a few things that the Anchorage nonprofit adds on top of the IRS training in order to make sure that we're prepared for the fishing revenues.
Sure. So I wanted to know about how this turned into a kind of partnership as well with Western Michigan University. How was that able to be formed?
So the way that the nonprofit in Anchorage works is if you live in Alaska, you can do weekend trips to villages. However, with regards to those of us who live in the lower 48, it's not practical for us to fly to Alaska just to go for a weekend trip. Mm-hmm. So for people that want to participate from the lower 48, the nonprofit establishes institutional partnerships. We go up for 9 days. So there's training in Anchorage, and then we go out into the villages for a week, and then there's debriefing in Anchorage afterwards. So because of the distance and commuting, it's a more thoroughgoing investment, and it gets formalized in these other ways. And then we're really lucky here at Western because we have a very good accounting program. So when I was there last year, those of us participating were lawyers who didn't really have any background, and we did fine to go through the training. Mm-hmm. But working with accounting students this year, I think it was less work for them to get trained than it would have been for those of us who didn't have any background in accounting.
Now, when it comes to that, how did it go about, number one, convincing Western Michigan University to partner on this program? And then number two, convincing the actual accounting students from here to, hey, let's spend a week in a remote village in Alaska. Is that a hard thing?
So to recruit the accounting students, I just sent an email to the chair of the accounting department, Don Gribben, and he circulated, and I got a really strong response. And then there was, and then worked through the applicants and picked four who were extraordinarily good.
So there were more than four applicants then? How many applicants were there?
Oh, gosh. At various stages, early on, I'd say about maybe 25 expressed interest in participating.
Wow.
Most of whom were accounting. There were a few who were non-accountants. The arrangement is that the Anchorage nonprofit provides all the expenses within Alaska, which includes the travel to the villages, but we have to get university funding to get to Anchorage in the first place. The College of Business was very supportive, and Dean Palin, in terms of getting us the funding to get to Anchorage in the first place. Mm-hmm. As for how to get the students, it was interesting. We did our first meeting, and I'm not that interested in taxes. I just want to go to rural Alaska. And so I took a poll, and I said, how many of you are here because it's in Alaska, and how many of you are here because it's this, you know, training program run through the IRS that would credentialize you in important ways? And almost all of the students said, we're here because of the credential. We're here. Really? We went in on our resume. We don't care so much that it's in Alaska. And I was subsequently told by one of the students that at least she said that because she thought that's what I wanted to hear, whereas I didn't care at all what they said. But I really think the students, it's a prestigious program for them to participate in, and I think it does add a lot to their resumes. And it shows a very serious commitment. Not just toward tax, but to public service, to go to rural Alaska for a week and help underprivileged groups do their taxes. I think that is very important and speaks a lot to the students that wanted to go. However, after the trip was over, some of them equivocated on their answers and admitted that, you know, being in Alaska really was a lot of fun. One of the students' moms does sled dog racing, so I think she was a kindred spirit in getting out there, and And I hope, anyway, I'll look forward to going back next year. And I think one of the students graduates, the other three are still available. And then I hope I can continue to build and expand the program and take more students.
Mm-hmm. Are there different types of institutional partnerships with states or state schools like Western or with different programs that aren't just based in Alaska? Are there lots of other teams besides just the team from Western that are in like the Continental 48?
There's four teams from the Continental. Mm-hmm. There's four teams from the lower 48, and they're Western Michigan, University of Montana, Montana State, and University of Washington. And those are all with, it turns out they're all with accounting programs, though University of Washington has a second team that's from their law school.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, that almost everyone who goes is either an accounting student or a law student specializing in tax law.
Hmm.
And so again, you don't have to have any background in any of this to participate in the program. You just have to commit to the 40 hours of training. But it's the tax law students and the accounting students that are the most obvious pools to draw from.
Yeah, it is unique though, because now I feel like when you look at the people participating in this program, it's Alaska, it's Northwest United States, and then randomly now just Western Michigan University, which is pretty great.
Well, I'll take credit for that. And I think it's because I really fell in love with Alaska living there last year. My family lives in Northwest Montana, so it's always been sort of an area of the country, the Northwest, that appeals to me. But, you know, the other, interestingly, my friend, he was his partnership was with New York University. And I cannot even imagine going from Manhattan, which is where NYU is, out to rural Alaska. I mean, you can't imagine a starker juxtaposition.
Totally different.
Just crazy. And I got really strung out coming back because I flew back from the rural villages to Seattle. And I had 2 days in Seattle. And I was staying on the 25th floor of a Marriott. And I remember calling my wife, looking out the window at all the traffic and just the tall building, and being like, this just doesn't feel quite right. It's just a huge change to go from 200 people, no roads, on snow machines to, you know, a sprawling city like Seattle. And, you know, and within just 12 hours, you know, the difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's a crazy adjustment.
So have you formed any connections with people from these villages that you've gone to visit, or has it been sort of a jump in there, leave, jump in there again? What's that been
so
like?
So the tax preparers, the students that I took with me were actually really active in making connections on Facebook. So, again, it's surprising to see these rural villagers on Facebook, but they are. And so, for example, one thing we wanted to bring home with us were walrus earrings, and the village that we were in didn't have any because they hadn't caught a walrus that year. You needed the ivory from their tusks. But the neighboring village, they had caught a walrus over there. They had tusks, and you know, one of their jewelry makers could make the earrings. So, you know, you just get on Facebook and you make friends and you send messages to this guy and say, hey, I need some walrus earrings. I hear you have the walrus tusk. And so it's sort of amazing that things like Facebook, you know, can do.
Mm-hmm. Are you guys hoping to go back to the same village next year to work with the same people?
I'm not. I had a great time, but I would much rather go to different villages. And so Alaska is really interesting insofar as there's all of these different regions because of the size, but they're very different. So the Aleutian Islands are comparatively warm. We were in Western Alaska, which is fishing based. I would really like to go to the interior north of Fairbanks, which is very, very cold. Where we were, it never got below 0 degrees, which is still pretty cold. But in north of Fairbanks, it can be 50 below. It's more hunting than fishing, of course, because it's not on the water. There's another mountain range there. There's more national parks. So I'm sort of using this program as an opportunity to explore the whole state of Alaska. And even though I made friends here, going back to the same village to me seems like, you know, a trade-off as against seeing new places.
What do you hope it grows into here at Western as well?
So ideally, I'd like to build and expand the program. So this year we took 4 students out, which is not only how much funding we had, but also how much capacity the nonprofit had to host us. Moving forward, I'd like to, you know, grow that number to, you know, as many as we can find support for. I think it'd be a lot of fun to coordinate larger teams that go out to Alaska either for longer periods of time or more often. So I think that's sort of my goal.
And is there still a big need for it, even with all these teams going out to these different places? Are there still villages that are being underserved from this as well? Or is there enough right now?
I think I don't know. I know that the nonprofit, they're okay. Well, I mean, here's a better way to answer the question. When we go out, we're doing taxes from about 8 a.m. till 10 p.m. The tax preparers are working very, very, very hard. And there's breaks to walk around the villages, but they're very, very long hours. And I think that if the nonprofit had more people, we could have more reasonable hours, more time to explore the culture and the villages. So they are the operating rule right now is, you know, you don't close so long as there's still someone who wants their taxes done. And that's very important, because if we leave, then, you know, they're on their own and there's risks there. But I think the program's doing an extraordinary job getting villagers serviced with their taxes and not, as it were, leaving anybody behind. But I think that they would like to expand and have, you know, greater capacity and maybe shorter hours for the tax preparers.
And I guess that probably might be in, like, well, there is clearly a service being provided to all of these villagers. It as a almost service to the tax preparers, it might be nice to, yeah, have a few other people around to
right.
help out.
Well, yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, one thing that I was really struck with, I mean, the students were extraordinary, but when we were leaving, everyone would hug us and say, oh, thank you. You've done so much for our village. And one of my students would always say, oh my gosh, you've done so much for us. I mean, we're the ones who've had the opportunity mm-hmm. to come out here and, of course, not only get something on our resume, but be able to experience whale and walrus and native traditions and rural Alaska and snow machines. And I really think that they believe that. I certainly do that. You know, what we get out of the program is easily as much as we put into it. And it really is a privilege to participate.